Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Aldi. I'm Charlotte Metcalf and my guest today is Nicholas Heitner, the extraordinarily talented theatre, opera and film director. I've long admired his work, so I feel very triumphant to have pinned him down. I'm here at the Bridge Theatre to talk to Nick about his phenomenal career and his new film with Alan Bennett, The Choral, which came out last Friday. Before founding the London Theatre Company with Nick Starr and moving here to the Bridge, Nick was director of the National Theatre and in 2010 was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for services to drama. Nick Heitner, at last, a very warm welcome to Radio Aldi.
Very, very happy to be here.
Well, thank you. Now, before we go back to anything, can we talk about The Choral, which I saw last night? It's immensely moving. Ralph Fiennes is brilliant. And it seems to me to encapsulate everything you love doing into one film. In many ways, it feels like the apotheosis and crowning glory of your career, with all these things thrown in it, music and theatre. And it's your fourth film with Alan Bennett, and you absolutely must have loved making it.
Yes, I really did love making it. It came about, he gave me a sketch for it 2 days before the first COVID lockdown. I have a covering note dated, so I know exactly when he gave it to me, and we knew what was about to happen. And he was apologetic, worried that it might feel frivolous to be giving me a script, an idea, at a time when none of us knew what was going to happen. Yeah. It took from then to June of last year for the cameras to roll. But that was down to me, really. I had so much to do just keeping the Bridge Theatre where we're sitting speaking going. It was Alan's old friend and frequent collaborator of mine too, George Fenton, composer, musician, who kept encouraging us to stick at it, selfless, because the choral contains none of George's music. There is no background music.
I hadn't even thought about that. There is no score.
No. There's no film score in the conventional sense, although it is, of course, saturated in music, but all the music is generated from within the film, from within the story. Mm-hmm.
Can we just go back to Alan Bennett for a minute? You met on Madness of King George III, did you? When you were
Before that. I offered, I think in 1990, I offered to Richard Eyre the idea of making a big family show out of The Wind in the Willows. And Richard put me together with Alan. I knew Alan only a very little. It was a pretty obvious idea. We both had it because it was not long after he recorded The Wind in the Willows for Radio 4. I think people still play it now to their kids. Mm-hmm. So we worked first together on his adaptation of that book at the National Theatre. And it was a couple of years after that that he came in the Madness of George III. We live quite close to each other. So he generally just puts things in an old envelope and pushes them through my door. In those days, Madness of George III, History Boys, the first draft was immensely long, too much material. These days it tends to be a little more slender. He wants more encouragement. He wants to be told it's worth pursuing.
How interesting. Well, he's so brilliant.
He genuinely wants to know whether I think there's a play in what he has begun to write. With the two earlier plays, Madness of George III and The History Boys, he obviously knew where he was going, what he was doing. There was a mass of material. But you know, he writes in many forms. So I wouldn't feel and haven't felt, diffident about suggesting that maybe the theatre isn't where this material's headed, as indeed I did with The Choral, which he thought might be a play, and I thought wasn't a play. I thought was and should be a film. Although the chance of a film getting made is always remote. Nobody would set out to make a film unless they were completely possessed. The world of independent filmmaking is under enormous pressure. Mm. It's easier if you work in film to get involved in a $250 million budget for a huge franchise with superheroes than it is to raise what it takes to do a modest period movie. But anyway, we did pull the money together for this.
When you started making films, what was the first film you made?
It was The Madness of King George.
Because he insisted you made it, didn't he?
He wanted to stay involved. And it wasn't so much that he put his foot down as that he wouldn't make his... he wouldn't make his material available to anybody who would not commit to Nigel Hawthorne and to me. And there was only one offer for that package. Sam Goldwyn Jr., the son of the more famous Sam Goldwyn, absolutely wonderful man, great anglophile, who saw the play and saw no reason to look any further. And it was with Sam Goldwyn Jr.'s encouragement that I made the first tentative step onto a film set. I really have no film school background. I have no technical education in filmmaking. So I learned on the job, really.
And it won a BAFTA.
It did, yes, it did. It was it really worked.
I'm interested in what... whose idea it was to have two Alan Bennetts in Lady with the Van.
Oh, that was Alan's idea, and that started on stage. That was two actors on stage. Because I think he felt his response to it was the point of telling the story as drama, was that he wanted to dramatise his divided response to her.
Yes.
The Lady in the Van appeared initially as... a long piece in the London Review of Books. It would be pushing it to say it was any more than a pamphlet.
It was very slight, and you have short. That in the movie. You see how small it was.
It was short, yes, and it was essentially a series of diary items. So that started essentially as a series of not even reminiscences. He was writing in a white hot fury sometimes about the latest indignity she'd visited on him. But when he finally decided to write a play, I think what interested him most was that he was both involved in the day-to-day business of dealing with her and interacting with her, and at the same time he knew he was being ruthless. He was recording what she did for future use. There's a part of the play and of the movie where she accuses him of using her. That of course is invention, but he felt that, of course, she was using him. She exploited him appallingly, but he used her too as material.
Did you meet her, the real material?
No, I never did. I saw her. I know, but this was before I knew Alan. I used to walk past his house and wonder what the hell was going on. I mean, she was ever present, but I didn't know him. When I first started to work with him on The Wind in the Willows, she had recently died, so she'd gone. And I never asked him, what was that van about? I never said what the hell was going on outside this house for all these years. There came a point where even his visitors stopped saying to him, what's going on in the drive? And people would politely ignore him.
So English.
Yeah.
Are you continuing to collaborate with him following this call? Because it's had fantastic reviews, hasn't it?
It's down to him now. What he, what he, what he. I know he's. Um, he's certainly got publishing plans. I mean, he's not done yet.
And the extraordinary thing about you is you're never done. I mean, because you started so quickly, you move very fast from opera into theatre and, you know,
yeah, I did, but not even by any particular design. Film was always a bonus. I never expected to work in film. I did my training, my apprenticeship in opera. I had experience in big stages, big statements, moving large numbers of people around before I started to work in great detail with actors. And I think in retrospect that was a real blessing. I was learning on an epic scale. You get to realise that a lot of really excellent theatre directors remain fearful of large stages, which I've never been.
Do you think Miss Saigon helped you do that? Because you were thrown at the deep end of that, weren't you?
No, that didn't so much help me as at that time. That came as a huge stroke of luck at exactly the right time when I was able to throw absolutely everything I knew. Too much, probably, I threw at it. So that felt like an opportunity. I've done nothing since which has had quite that theatrical extravagance.
But I've seen a couple of things here that are just breathtakingly good at the Bridge. I mean, your Guys and Dolls, which we talked about before, was absolutely sensational. And, of course, your absolutely wonderful Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, so the difference between them and something like an 80s musical, it's actually very little. It's very, very little. It's what's happening there is, and what is possible in the Bridge Theatre is with an arrangement, a format, which makes the audience part of the show, you can conjure up a sense of scale and life. And I tried it first with Julius Caesar, where I was able to make the standing part of the audience, the Roman mob, that felt like in some ways a more satisfying way of suggesting spectacle. Yes, those shows felt spectacular, but you'd be hard-pressed to tell me what the set was.
And do you think that's why you wanted to leave the National and have your own theatre?
No, I wanted to leave the National because I'd done my stint at the National. I did 12 years, which is like on the outer edge of how long it's possible to do it. Around 10 is about it. And that's because it just becomes too much, but also because someone else needs to have a go every 10 years. It cannot be comprehensively owned by any one person or group of people. It needs to change.
You've talked about growing up in a sort of typical sort of, you know, cultured Jewish family in Manchester. Did you see a lot of theatre as a child?
In Manchester, yes.
Did you?
There was in Manchester. But also, I used to go to Stratford at least twice a year, once with my parents and once with the school. I went to Manchester Grammar School, which was at the time a direct grant grammar school, both state funded and independent. In my world, what happened after 2010, when the coalition government came in, was obviously, direct arts funding was reduced in a way that went where there's an ongoing rumbling catastrophe. But it wasn't the worst thing they did. The worst thing they did, which the current government has just made noises about correcting, was the introduction of the EBAC, which has raised standards in STEM subjects. But removed from most state schools music, art and drama.
I couldn't agree with you more.
It's had an absolutely disastrous, irreparable effect,
yes,
on an entire generation of state school kids. So what happened as a result of that? One thing that happened was that the independent schools, who obviously cater to relatively few people, immediately doubled down on art, drama, music and sport. Doubled down on it because they knew that if they were taking large amounts of money off parents who in many cases couldn't really afford it, they had to offer them something,
yeah,
that was really going to benefit their pupils in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
In the state sector, it's not that there's none of it, because some individual principals have elected to put resources behind music education. There are some fantastic music departments in the state sector, but it's not something which the system has encouraged. In fact, the system has discouraged,
yes,
it. Now, there's a flip side to this, which is that in 2010, those of us who were involved in the performing arts and in the visual arts warned that the consequence of this would be that our workforce and our audience would homogenize, that it would be less and less diverse in educational and economic background, that the audience and the workforce would look increasingly like they came from the private sector. That happened. And this is a long complaint, but it needs to be said.
It needs to be said, now I'm enjoying it.
At the same time, theatres, orchestras, galleries, museums, dance companies all started to use more of their dwindling resources on trying to paper over the cracks on their education and outreach programs. But we can only scratch the surface. If it's not happening in school, there is a ceiling to what we can achieve.
Mm.
Government then turned around and said, your audience isn't diverse enough. You're not reaching working class people. You're not reaching state educated pupils. Your workforce looks like it is increasingly coming from the independent sector, from private schools. And is it too posh? If someone had wanted to devise a conspiracy, first of all, to put the art sector on the ropes by lessening investment in it. Secondly, to engineer an audience and a workforce that felt like it was less worthy of investment than it once did, they wouldn't have been able to come up with a better script.
Mm.
Okay, I've said all that. At the same time, I don't feel pessimistic, because although I could not put my hand on my heart and say that the people making art, performing or visual, are as widely various in terms of experience and background as they used to be in the 60s and 70s,
yeah,
as they used to be,
yeah,
I couldn't say that. What they share...
Sort of Joe Orton's and people like,
yeah,
that.
The people who came through art school in the 60s. David Hockney.
Yes, yes.
Alan Bennett.
Yes.
The Beatles. Harold Pinter. It's not that there's nobody like them. It's just that we used to be able to produce those with relative ease. The atmosphere was different. But what hasn't changed is that to make art, you just need to be insanely optimistic and enthusiastic and positive. That hasn't changed. There are still people who can make what is essentially a broken system work. There are people who can do that. And they do it with tremendous invention and enthusiasm and talent. But I'm afraid if you look at it, who was coming through in the 60s and who is coming through now, it looks to me as if there are lots of people who should be coming through who aren't because they were never told about it.
And not being encouraged.
Yeah. You're good at music. You play in an orchestra. Not just your social skills, but your educational attainment rises. That's what the studies show. So I just hope that this can be turned around. I hope it can be.
Also, just going back to the choral for a moment, I mean, what a wonderful illustration of what music can do for
the
community.
You can. You can't get rosy about that. You can't get too rosy about that.
Went off to war.
Yeah, they all went off to war. But also, of course, yes, they're singing and they're adept in music making because that is the entertainment that was available to them. All the things that are available now and distract all of us now, not just kids, but we're all of us ludicrously distracted by our phones and our education and our attention spans have shortened. And there's a half, I think, of me and everybody that I know that wants to fling the phone into the river.
Yes, most oldest.
Yeah, but we are essentially as addicted to it as everybody else. Social media, maybe not. That feels to me like pure poison and a step too far, and not interested. But the community in the choral that comes together to sing Elgar, there's no TV to switch on. There's no other way of entertaining yourself except by making music together in this community. So we can't kind of make a direct read across. But yeah, what I hope it does do is say that if you do get involved in communal music making, it makes your life a lot better.
Just before we go back to opera for a minute, can we just talk very quickly about the Lightroom? Because that's something you've invested in, and it's yours, isn't it? It's absolutely. I mean, anybody who saw the Hockney show, I mean, it's the most brilliant way of introducing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's
genius.
Yes, with the Hockney show is absolutely wonderful, but then of course Hockney has always been way ahead of the curve in his use of technology in his interest in making things digital. Digitally, that was supposed to be a theatre, but COVID got in the way. So it's being used, and it's worked very well. It's being used as a space for environmental video shows.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
are you going to make it into a theatre?
Probably the next people will.
So going back to you, just to finish off with it, what I'm really interested in reading. Really, you're so modest. You don't think you're a genius at anything. what do you feel most confident in directing?
Oh, I feel much more confident in the theatre than in film. And I do think I think, of course, every now and then, if you work in my world, you come across people who really are geniuses, who have an immediately recognisable creative signature.
Like
Alan Bennett. And you come across performers who are blessed with something that can't be taught. Maggie Smith. Genius isn't a term that I would throw around lightly. But what I think I can do now is give a sense of purpose to a disparate group of very gifted people. And that is what direction is. As a director, I don't have a right. I'm an auteur. I'm not the kind of director who can sit down and write. As soon as I try to write dialogue, the bit of me which exercises quality control over dialogue rejects what I've written immediately. But as a director, I would expect to be able to help a writer to find the best version of what the writer thinks they're doing. And I would expect to be able to take everybody involved down the same road to the same destination. And Yeah, in the theatre, I think I can still. I'm not. God knows I'm not the cutting edge anymore. But I think I can still, particularly here at the Bridge, find new things to do which involve large audiences. I am confident in the theatre.
So what have you got? What's next? We've got Into the Woods coming up for Christmas here.
Yes, which I'm not directing, which I think is going to be absolutely great. A Sondheim masterpiece, which has been relatively little performed in London. Sondheim always knew in his Mordant way that once he was dead, he would be widely popular. And I think Into the Woods is now a great American classic, where once it was experimental. It's still experimental, but it's a great show, a great mashup of folk and fairy stories, of Brothers Grimm fairy stories. Mashed up Cinderella, Red Riding Hood, Rapunzel, Jack and his cow and his mother, the baker and his wife, going into real woods. I mean, staggeringly real woods. I think it's going to look great. In high Renaissance fairy tale gear, but it's also super contemporary. I think it's a great show.
What's the one thing left that you really, really want to direct?
No, well, I think what I always want to direct is something new. There are old plays. I've done a lot of the old plays that I wanted to do. There are one or two. I never disappointed. I'm never disappointed when I do Shakespeare. The audience sometimes is. But I always find something, even in Shakespeare plays, which I'm expecting not to deliver as much as Hamlet. They always do. But what really interests me, now I think what really interests most of us is helping new stuff onto the stage that an audience has never seen before. And so I hope there'll still be more of that.
Well, what a great and positive note to end on, despite all your gloom.
Well, the gloom, as I say, the gloom is about the damage that was done.
Yes. Mm.
The people who are making theatre, the people who are making art, are as energetic, as inventive as they've always been. They're finding new solutions to impossible situations. It's just hard not to be angry about the generation that was robbed of it and the damage that was done.
Mm, I agree. Well, you're doing a lot for art, and everything you do is wonderful. So thank you, Nick, and please keep going.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Nicholas Heitner. If you enjoyed listening to us and want to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, an enormous thank you to you, Nicholas Heitner. At last we got you on Radio Oldie. To you, Bailey Gifford, for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Thank you. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.